Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The immigration debate is covered endlessly in the media, but very few who write about immigration know what it's like to make the harrowing journey from Mexico to the United States. Today's guest, anthropologist Seth Holmes, crossed the U.S.-Mexico border with a group of indigenous Mexican migrant workers so he could experience firsthand what that arduous and life-risking trek is like. He lived with the same people for 2 summers in migrant farm worker camps in the Skagit Valley of Washington State picking berries and spent winters with them in California pruning grapevines. The indigenous Oaxacan workers Holmes lived and labored with spend 7 days a week in the fields, no matter the weather. They suffer a wide range of health problems with very little health care provided. One of the workers, Abelino, told Seth, quote, "You pick with your hands bent over kneeling. Your back hurts. You get knee pains and hip pains. You suffer a lot." But Holmes says farm workers are mostly hidden. In fact, they're hidden in plain view. The terrifying and often fatal passage across the border, the squalid conditions of the labor camps, the back-breaking work in the fields, migrants do this year after year to earn an annual wage of about $5,000 to $8,000. And that's the economic engine that puts fresh fruits and vegetables on our plates. Seth Holmes writes, quote, "We consciously hide from ourselves the difficult realities of the workers. We somewhat know them, but we don't think about them much," end quote. Seth Holmes is a cultural and medical anthropologist and physician. He's an assistant professor of public health and medical anthropology at UC Berkeley, and he writes about his experience in the book Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States. He worked for more than a decade on this book, living in labor camps, picking fruit and pruning plants on farms, migrating and crossing the U.S.-Mexico desert border with undocumented Mexican migrant farm workers. And Seth joins me in studio. Hi, Seth. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. This was really an amazing book. And I want to start off by describing what you look like. You're a white guy, bald, a beard, pretty tall. And you really, you're part of this book because, for obvious reasons, you lived with migrants, you crossed the border with them. And that's pretty rare when you look at books on immigration. So first off, how did you manage to gain the trust of these people?
That's a good question. So I started trying to gain trust in California, in the Central Valley, working on farms and trying to meet with farmers and farm workers. I was able to make some inroads through the United Farm Workers and farm workers who had been involved in organizing, but it was hard in California to ever get to meet with any of the farm owners, any of the growers, to get permission to be on the farms. In Washington State, I spent part of a summer while I was trying to figure out where to do this immigration research and food research, visiting a backpacking guide who used to work for an organization that I was a backpacking guide for. Since that time, he'd become a social worker and worked with indigenous Mexican farm workers, Triqui and Mixtec people. And while I was visiting with him, he introduced me to a lot of the Triqui farm workers, and I think that helped somewhat in gaining trust. While I was visiting with him, I stayed with my childhood next-door neighbor, who had become a Methodist pastor in the Skagit Valley in a rural church, and she and I actually sang an Amy Grant duet that we used to sing when we were kids hiking in the snow in eastern Washington. After we sang the song to her little church, she introduced me to farm owners who went to her church, who happened to be the farm owners of the same farm that I had already met the indigenous farm workers on through the social worker. So it was kind of lucky in certain ways. The farm owner, after hearing me sing with his pastor, said, "Well, come meet with me tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. at the office in the farm, and we'll talk about the possibilities." And I think through that serendipity, both with the farm owner and with the social worker and the farm workers, I was able to live in the labor camp, pick berries on the farm, get to know some of the farm workers, specifically the indigenous native Mexicans, who are even less known, less seen than northern Mexican, mestizo Mexicans who work on farms.
Now, before you did this, did you know what was involved in crossing the border? Did you know what it was like to work on a farm? Did you know how harrowing this experience really is?
So as an anthropologist, the research that I do is kind of the classic participant observation. It's different than most social science research where you do surveys or you go do observations or interviews because you do it also yourself on a certain level. So there's different kinds of knowing. There's the knowing with your mind by reading things, by talking with people, and there's the knowing with your body by experiencing it yourself. And the answer to the knowing with your mind is that, yes, I knew what it was like to cross the border. I knew the statistics of people dying. I knew about dehydration and heat stroke. I knew about working on farms and the hours and things like that. But until I experienced it for myself, I didn't really know what it was like. The fear and anxiety and difficulty of carrying enough water to be able to deal with the heat and in the desert, the difficulty of working 7 days a week. I only worked 1 or 2 days a week, and the rest of the days I did interviews. So even that I didn't really learn fully. But experiencing it for myself with my own body was definitely a big part of what the book is about, both about the experiences of the farm workers and what they're saying, but also me writing about, you know, this is what it felt like for me, which isn't necessarily the same as what it felt like for them, but it's definitely important information.
You spent a lot of your time, most of your time, with the Triqui indigenous people from Oaxaca, Mexico. And you say that they are the bottom rung of agricultural workers in the United States. Tell us about them.
So in the U.S., a lot of agriculture is organized on a hierarchy of different races or ethnicities and a hierarchy of citizenship, where if you're a white person working in agriculture, you're more likely to have certain kinds of jobs and maybe own the farm. If you're a mestizo Mexican from northern Mexico, you're more likely to have other kinds of jobs. And if you're indigenous or you're from Central America and indigenous, then you're more likely to have the jobs that you're most directly working in the soil, most directly bent over, kind of using your body to do the work. So the Triqui people who I worked with speak their own indigenous language, a complicated tonal language that I learned some words of, but it would have been another decade of research in order for me to learn their whole language. And they come from relatively small villages, small towns in the mountains of Oaxaca, where they largely have their own family farms. And one of the things you and I were talking about before the show, Rose, was about the food movements and foodies in the Bay Area. And in some sense, I would probably count myself among foodies. And a lot of us who are interested in local food, organic food, good tasting food, California cuisine, we picture family farms where people are working at the pace that they want to work. They're doing different kinds of jobs during the day. They're planting, they're harvesting. They're not always doing the same thing. And in lots of ways, these Triqui people have those kinds of farms that we would picture as the idealistic, perfect kind of farm that we want to support as foodies. But for various reasons, including the North American Free Trade Agreement, that's made it harder for them to be able to survive in Mexico, they've been forced to cross the border, come into the U.S., and then work on our more corporate farms, doing roughly the same job all day long, which inevitably is worse for your body if you're doing the same thing 7 days a week versus kind of varied work. So it's a sad irony that the kinds of farms that they had to leave at home are exactly the kind of farms that a lot of us in the U.S. who care about our food would want to support. And now they've had to come and support our farms in a different way.
And as you point out, for so many of them, the overwhelming majority of them, this is not a choice that they're making.
Right.
They feel like if they don't come to the U.S. to make $5,000 to $8,000 a year, their children might not have an education. They might not have a chance at having decent housing. And so they don't really have a choice.
Right. You're reminding me of getting ready to cross the border with some of the Triqui men when we were in the town of Altar in Sonora State in Mexico. Marcario, one of the Triqui men, and I went to the cathedral in the central square in that little town. and planned to light candles and pray for safe passage, mm-hmm. which a lot of people were doing, but we sort of ran out of time. But while we were there, I noticed a lot of posters that were hand-drawn with different dangers, scorpions or rattlesnakes or someone dying of heat stroke under the bright sun or a bandit with a pistol or something. And then in bright red letters in Spanish, each of them said, "Is it worth risking your life?" And my first thought when I was there was the answer has to be yes, it's worth risking your life because hundreds of thousands of people are trying to do that each year. But as an anthropologist, I'm trained not just to answer the questions, but also to question the questions. Then there's a sense in which that question, is it worth risking your life, assumes that the crossing is a rational choice, is a choice made by people, it's experienced as a choice, and that they could easily just decide, no, I'm not going to cross. But in all my interviews and all my participant observation, I never heard any of the tricky people speak about it as a choice, experience it as a choice, talk through pros and cons. They all said more something like, there's no other option left for us. We're forced to do this. And if we think a little bit more about the North American Free Trade Agreement and what free trade means in that particular context, we can see some ways that these tricky people have been forced to cross. For example, the North American Free Trade Agreement has disallowed the U.S., Mexico, and Canada from having tariffs on goods from other countries, but it hasn't disallowed an inverse tariff, which we call a subsidy. Mm-hmm. So the U.S., which is relatively more wealthy, has increased farm subsidies for corn by over 300% since the signing of NAFTA. And many of the tricky people who I write about, including Marcardio, who went with me to the cathedral, have started coming since the North American Free Trade Agreement was signed because they have seen corporately grown corn from the U.S. underselling their corn in the towns right nearby. So no longer can they pay for electricity or buy the uniforms for the public schools and things like that.
Talk a little bit about what it was like to be in Altar, the desert town where you stopped in northern Mexico. You write that, quote, "My skin is already peeling from the dry, hot wind in the bus and the sun that came through the window. Now I begin sweating profusely. This town scares me. It's impossible to know which person dressed in dark clothing is an assailant wanting money from easy targets and which is a person hoping to cross the border. Macario tells me to guard my money. He remarks, people know how to take your money without you even noticing. I push an empty soda bottle in my pocket above my money and I feel a bit safer. These are people, mostly men, from all over Mexico and Latin America. Some appear to be people from Mexico City, but most look like people from rural Mexico." And so this is basically a town set up for people who are crossing the border.
That's definitely how it felt. There were money exchange places. There were places you could send money over the wire. There were grocery stores, and the grocery stores had aisles of Gatorade and aisles of Pedialyte and aisles of different sizes of water.
I just want to ask, because I was visualizing this while reading, and you said you're in really good shape, right? Sort of good shape. But it was amazing to read how fast you have to run. And you've got these barbed wire fences over you. Can you explain just what that looks like? I was trying to visualize just people running and no lights because you don't want the Border Patrol to see you.
That's right. Right. So we're hiking through the desert with cacti and barbed wire fences. We started around sunset and went through the night. We didn't use any lights because you don't want the Border Patrol or anyone or assailants to find you. So that means that sometimes you crash into the spines of cacti or other things or lose your way. It definitely was a scary situation where you're in the middle of the desert with sand all around you and everything looks kind of the same. So I would have had no idea where to go. And we crossed, I'm not sure, at least a dozen barbed wire fences where we had to either climb over or under or kind of get through in between the barbed wire fences. And it was unclear to me which of those were set up by ranchers who were trying to protect their land, which were set up by the Border Patrol that were trying to protect the border, what other ones were there for.
So how are you able to carry water with you during this journey? Because I know some groups actually place water in the desert for people who are thirsty, and then you've got people who punch holes in them
right.
because they don't want the water right. to be delivered.
Right. One of those organizations, Humane Borders, puts large blue water barrels in the desert because there's so many people dying in the desert every year. But then you're right, there are other people who shoot holes or punch holes in them because they don't want the people who might be dying to get water because they don't want Mexican people to get water. So we carried water in our backpacks. All of us wore dark-colored clothes. All of us had small backpacks. We all had as many gallons of water and Gatorade and Pedialyte as we could carry, which, you know, could easily not be enough if you made the wrong turn or it was too hot or you got stuck because of assailants or because of the Border Patrol or another group. So I drank through a gallon of water every few hours while I was hiking, and we definitely hiked as fast as we could. We didn't talk at all. We just moved.
I'm speaking with Seth Holmes. He's a cultural and medical anthropologist and physician. He's an assistant professor of public health and medical anthropology at UC Berkeley. And he writes about his experience in the book Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States. For about 7 years, he lived in labor camps. He picked fruit and pruned plants on farms in California and Washington. He migrated and crossed the U.S.-Mexico desert with undocumented Mexican migrant farm workers, and they all got arrested. And we'll also talk about that story. So there's so many stories about migration and the border, but we rarely hear the human side of what it's like for people who risk their lives to cross the border to make about $5,000 to $8,000 picking our fruits and vegetables. So what do you want to know about migrant farm workers? And if you work in the fields, if you work near the fields, what questions do you have? Seth writes that we consciously hide from ourselves the difficult realities of the workers. We somewhat know them. We might see them, but we don't think about them much. So what are your thoughts on that? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Can you also just talk about all of the different people that are involved in the crossing? Because you wrote that you just don't know who to trust. And you're sometimes in cars. You don't know where you're being taken. You have to spend the night in horrific, squalid conditions. You don't know what's going to happen in the middle of the night. And that's the other thing that we just don't hear much about.
Right. There's a way that everyone in Altar, for example, is dressed in these dark clothes. Everyone looks like they could be getting ready to cross the border. At the same time, you generally know that everyone's carrying a fair amount of cash on them. At that time, it was $1,000 to $2,000. Since then, it's gone up. And that cash is for food. It's for the border crossing guide, who's called a coyote. It's for the rides on either side of the border. So everyone's a very easy target in lots of ways. So the people who you see dressed kind of darkly could either be crossers or could be people who are trying to hide in the shadows and pull a gun out on you and take the money from you. So it was definitely a scary situation. We didn't know who to trust.
So it costs between $1,500 and $2,500, and that money goes to various people along the way for rides and guidance?
Correct. Yep. A lot of it goes to the coyote, depending on the agreement, either paid on the Mexican side, regardless of whether you cross, or we were lucky in a sense that we were crossing with a coyote who the people knew, who was also treaky. And the agreement with him was we would pay him once we arrived on the other side safely, which was a better situation than a lot of people have. For example, people who come from Central America come to the border towns and don't know what coyote they're going to cross with, have a lot harder time figuring out which person to trust. Whereas we knew that this person lived in San Miguel in the mountains of Oaxaca. Everyone kind of knew him and his family, so there was a little more reason that we should be able to trust him.
Tell us about some of the people you crossed the border with.
I crossed with Macario, who I originally got to know in Washington State on the strawberry farm. I lived very close to him in one of the labor camp shacks and went to his child's baptism and kind of learned how to dance a little bit like the Treaky people did from him and some of his friends because they liked to dance at baptisms and other you know, Christmas parties and things. And then some of his friends, who included Jaime, whose family was still in California. He had gone back to San Miguel in the mountains of Oaxaca in order to celebrate the Patron Saint Festival and Christmas.
And this is one reason why a lot of the people who leave Mexico for the U.S. actually go back every year.
Right.
Because they want to go to this festival.
Right.
They want to obviously see their families.
Right. And that's kind of the moment that they reconnect with their hometowns, their extended families. Usually they'll go back. Not everyone goes back now because the border has been made so much more difficult to cross that, and more expensive to cross because of that, that more dangerous to cross, that a lot of people are staying in the U.S. ironically. So closing the border hasn't actually meant keeping these people out. It's meant keeping a lot of the people in. But when people do go back, they tend to go back, harvest corn, go to the Patron Saint Festival, have Christmas with their family, plant corn, and then come back to the U.S.
What happened when you were crossing the border into Arizona and were met by Border Patrol?
Right. So there was a moment when we arrived in our destination in Arizona that...
And I'm just, can you just describe what you were feeling at that moment? Like, how did your body feel?
Right.
What were you smelling?
Right. So we finally were in a place where there were trees, because during the whole crossing, we'd been kind of near cacti, but no trees. So in some ways, I kind of felt a little more at home. I grew up in Washington State with a lot of trees. So we laid down under torn open trash bags, kind of as blankets, in a dried up creek bed under these trees. And I was exhausted, but kind of feeling a little hopeful, like, gosh, we're finally here. Our coyote went off to figure out a ride for us to get past the internal Border Patrol checkpoint. So there's the checkpoint at the border, and then there's another checkpoint further in. And we needed to get a ride past that in order not to be sort of stopped there. So he came back and explained that the Border Patrol activity had become too strong in that area and that his contacts would no longer give rides. So we started discussing what to do about it. Some of the tricky men thought that if we pooled our money, we could buy a car, and they suggested that I drive them. And I said, I can't do that. That would be a felony. That would mean I wouldn't be able to work. And they, respecting the need to work, didn't push that. So then our coyote went back again to find someone else to give us a ride. All of a sudden, he ran toward us, jumped down in the creek bed, spoke really quickly in Triqui, and then two Border Patrol agents jumped down after him, one black and one white, and pointed their guns at us, told us to raise our hands, take any toothbrushes out of our bags, leave them there in the desert. And I was... I haven't had a gun pulled on me before, so... that was terrifying in its own way.
And you got separated from the tricky men, so you were put in different cells?
Right. So I was separated from them right off the bat, and the Border Patrol agent who had me told me, this doesn't look good for you with a bunch, a USC with a bunch of illegals. And by USC, he meant US citizen.
And it seemed like the Border Patrol were just disgusted by your actions. Like, how could you do something like this? And they didn't understand why you would do something like this.
Right. The kind of head of that unit of the Border Patrol said something like that to me. How could you be so selfish to break the laws for your thesis? And I wanted, you know, in my head I was thinking, well, I looked into the risks and benefits. I talked with lawyers. I really wanted to be able to understand this in order to raise awareness about what's going on in our food system, what's going on in our international policies. But you can't say that when someone has a gun and can put you in jail.
And that's exactly what happened. We're talking with Seth Holmes, author of the book Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies. For 7 years, he lived in labor camps. He picked fruit and pruned plants on farms in California and Washington State. He migrated and crossed the U.S.-Mexico border with undocumented Mexican migrant farm workers. And today we're talking about their personal stories. What do you want to know about what farm workers actually face? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields.
Les This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. If you have a perspective that you've not yet heard in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255, toll-free 866-798-TALK, or you can send your email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
It's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will be discussing coverage of the 11th anniversary of the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. Yesterday was the 11th anniversary of the invasion. So how are the media marking the anniversary, and what has become of Iraq 11 years later? We'll also discuss media coverage of the midterm elections in the U.S. We'll be joined by The Guardian's Martin Chuloff and Salon's new columnist, Thomas Frank, author of What's the Matter with Kansas. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I'm speaking with Seth Holmes, a cultural and medical anthropologist and physician. He's assistant professor of public health and medical anthropology at UC Berkeley, and he's out with a new book, Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States. For 7 years, Seth lived in labor camps. He picked fruit and pruned plants on farms here in California and in Washington. He migrated and crossed the U.S.-Mexico border with undocumented Mexican migrant farm workers to really find out what they deal with, why they leave Mexico, and then what life is like when they make it to the United States and pick our fruits and vegetables. Seth writes that we consciously hide from ourselves the difficult realities of the workers. We somewhat know them, but we don't think about them much. And I know so many of you live in the Central Valley and live near farms. If you work on a farm, we'd love to hear from you. If you work with farm workers, what do you think we need to know about what they really face? Because in the immigration debate, we really don't hear much about this at all. We have full lines. We'll have one open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose. Good morning, Seth. I teach at the Labor and Community Studies Department of City College, and Seth, can't wait to get your book into our library. Number one, thank you for your great work. And number two, we're doing a similar project with domestic workers in the mission, Women's Collective, La Colectiva de Mujeres. We're going to have a show in May. Rose, I'll invite you to that, where they're talking about their journey across the border and establishing themselves here. And I wanted to ask Seth in particular, did you have much experience with women and children crossing the border, as these women have been telling us? And also a little more, I know you already spoke to it, about how it's been getting increasingly difficult, more expensive, more dangerous, and how that affects whole families that come, women and children who come. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Sure. Thanks, Bill. And thanks for the reminder of the colectiva. So the people who I knew, the Triqui people, all came as families. Marcardio and Jaime and the other people who I write about came with their wives and with their kids. Some of them had kids here during the time that they were working. And over the past 7 years, I've been following them and their families. End up writing more about the men, partially because the men tend to go through school longer in Oaxaca, which means that they speak Spanish more fluently, and the women tend not to go through school as long and therefore speak Triqui as their primary language and Spanish not quite as fluently. And there were other difficulties in terms of access for doing lots of prolonged interviews for me as the white guy with the women in the tribe. But I do write about women, Marcelina and some of the others, in terms of their experiences picking, their experiences in healthcare, their experiences without translation in healthcare, things like that. But it's definitely, for this group of people, it's a family affair. The working in the fields is a family affair, living in the labor camps together, et cetera. So it's not the picture that we usually hear about farm workers or migrants the way it used to be, where men all left their families in Mexico and came up alone.
Did you happen to see the documentary, the Frontline documentary, Rape in the Fields, about sexual assault and rape?
I did, yep. And it was made partially with the Center for Investigative Reporting right. over at Berkeley.
Right. Correct? We did a show about that.
Great.
Did you happen to talk with anyone about this issue?
I did. So on the farm where I was working, I hadn't heard of, I didn't hear about sexual assault. But since that time when I was living on the farm full time, which was a year and a half, migrating full time with this group of people, I've heard several stories about different kinds of sexual assault, both of women and of men, and have worked some on a lawsuit against a large farm here in California related to sexual assault.
This also happens on the border as they're crossing.
Right. That was one of the places that I heard about it.
All right. Well, we've got a related question on this from Christina in San Francisco. Hi, Christina. Are you there? Oh, sorry, we lost you. Let's go next to Claudia and Elsa Bronte. Hi, Claudia.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Just thank you for the book, first of all. And then I had a question and also a little story to add. The question is whether you or part of or an organization using your material is talking to Congress. I'm thinking of when the Farm Bill is put together and the discussion of subsidies for the corn growers in the United States comes up, perhaps this would be a good time to put your information forward. And then also when they're having discussions about a guest worker program, if this would be, you know, something that you could get to Congress. You know, maybe they know, but maybe being confronted with the details and the human side of it, they might take it a little more seriously. And then my comment is that I used to work for the Sonoma Index Tribune and had the opportunity to interview some grape harvesters there. And one of the things that I saw that was very touching was that there was an elderly guy who was clearly undocumented who could no longer cut at the speed that he needed to get the kind of income that he needed. He was doing his best, but he couldn't quite bring in the quota that he was supposed to bring in. And so the younger guys would help him, you know, risking their own, risking having less money themselves, but they would all get together and help him because he needed the money and there was no social service available for him since he was undocumented.
Right. Great story. Mm. Good question. So interestingly, two artists up in Washington State, Alfred Currier and Ann Schrievogel, along with the California Institute for Rural Studies, sent a copy of the book with a policy-oriented summary of the book to every senator, every representative in Congress, the president, vice president, first lady, governor and secretary of state of California, and governor and secretary of state of Washington, so roughly 540-something books.
Mm. Hopefully they'll read it.
Yeah, I don't know that they'll read it, but hopefully at least their aides will read it and talk about it, or at least they'll look at the two-page summary.
Congress too. Sometimes they have opportunities for that where you could simply stand up and tell people, but you know that's not exactly your line of work, but I'm hoping somebody will be going that direction.
Right. There's a way that I chose to write the book more about real human beings, individuals who are migrants, who are working on farms, as opposed to more broad blanket statements about immigrants do this or immigrants do that, because oftentimes in the policy debates, that's the kind of, we hear statements like immigrants drain our economy. But then if you actually look at the real human beings who are working, there's a lot of ways that they don't. For example, all of the tricky people I know pay sales tax, because we all do. All of them have Social Security tax and other federal taxes, local taxes, county taxes taken out of their paycheck every week. And even though they make, you know, less than $8,000 a year, they don't get any of those taxes refunded at the end of the year, and they can't get Social Security in the end. So very interesting to me, the chief of the Border Patrol in Washington State, in an interview with me, told me that he's convinced that Social Security in the U.S. would have gone bankrupt already if it weren't for immigrants paying into it who then can't get their taxes refunded and can't benefit from Social Security later. So not only are a lot of these people providing us with the fruit and vegetable that help us be healthy, but also they're contributing to our economy in important ways that somehow through blanket statements we forget.
Well, thank you for calling in, Christina. I wanted to just ask you quickly about strawberries, because Christina was talking about quotas. And this is another thing that, and I don't know if many people know how the payment system works. Do you get paid by the hour because of minimum wage laws, or is there a quota system? And then I had never heard of these checkers, the people that actually have to check how much you pick. And oftentimes these are white teenagers who do this work.
Right. So the way that it worked on the farms where I worked, you do have to be paid minimum wage, supposedly, although we see a lot of labor laws not being enforced in the case of immigrant workers in agriculture. On all the farms that we worked in California, we were actually never paid minimum wage, which is against the law, but not being enforced. In Washington State, they were always paid minimum wage, but the way they were paid was per pound. So they, at the time, the state minimum wage was $7.16, and they made 14 cents per pound of strawberries. So in order to be able to make minimum wage and keep their job, they had to pick 50 pounds of de-leafed, ripe strawberries every hour, which also meant that, by and large, they didn't take time to eat lunch. They didn't take time to drink water because they didn't want to have to take time to use the porta potty, because if you don't make the minimum wage for the day, you'll be fired for a day, have one more chance to work, and then if you can't do it a second time, you're usually fired, and then you can't live in the labor camp anymore, since the labor camp is just for employees.
Well, now I would like to welcome Viviana Aguirre to the show. She's in her late 20s and lives in Oxnard, California. And Viviana came from Mexico when she was just 5 years old. She's a UFW union member at Maranaca Farms, where she picks and cuts bunches of parsley and cilantro. She's worked there for the last 3 years, and she began working in the fields as a summer job when she was just 15 years old. Hi, Viviana. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
So you've been hearing part of our conversation with Seth, and I just wonder, what are your thoughts on just the importance of letting people know what it's really like to work in the farms? I mean, I understand that you're on your knees all day cutting bunches of parsley and cilantro.
Yeah, I just want to know, like, it's pretty hard being working like that all day and on our knees. Yeah, we just... It's hard, you know, working on fields, picking up the parsley, bunches of cilantro.
So you started working in the fields when you were 15, and now you're in your late 20s.
Yes.
So can you just talk about, you know, what it's like? Because Seth worked in the fields, and he writes a lot about how difficult it is on the body, how much pressure, you know, just what it feels like. So talk a little bit about that.
My job, what I'm doing, it's too much pressure. Like, we're working on our knees. It's too much pressure. Like, our weight is on our knees. When we stop working, it's too, like, you feel your body so with a lot of pain. Your whole body, it's in pain.
And do you have any access to health care?
Excuse me?
Do you have access to health care?
Health care?
Yes. Do you have access to doctors?
No, we don't have any.
So what do you do at the end of the day when you're in so much pain? How do you deal with that?
Well, when we stop, just go home and rest for a little while. Just put like hot water in our feet so we can just rest.
And how often do you work? How many days a week and how many hours a day?
We work to Monday to Sunday. And we work to 7 until all day, 7 in the morning all day.
So 7 days a week?
Yes.
Seth, how common is that?
The farms that I worked in California, most of the farms were working 6 days a week here, which is the law in the state, but not all farms are having that enforced. In Washington State, most of the farms are working 7 days a week because there isn't a state law for agricultural workers to have any days off.
Viviana, you work on a farm in Oxnard, California. How are you treated? Do you feel like you're treated well, or do you feel like you're paid well as a union member?
We are treated well. We're treated well. We have a union farmer here.
What was that?
So you're...
It's a union farmer.
Uh-huh.
So, Viviana, you're working on a farm that has a UFW contract?
The UFW contract, yes.
Okay, great. And what do you know about how conditions are different on that farm because of the contract versus some of the other farms nearby that don't have contracts?
The conditions.
What kind of conditions are different?
Could you repeat the question, please?
Which kind of conditions are different? ¿O cómo están diferentes las condiciones?
The manager? The farmer gathered good with us.
Well, he was asking, what's the difference between your farm and another farm that doesn't have a UFW contract?
Oh, yeah, but when we have the union contract, they treated us better. They have more respect at us. And without the union contract, it's not the same. It's different. They don't treat you with respect. They just treat you like whatever, you know.
How many farms? I mean, how can we find out what farm has a UFW contract?
Good question. So a few points about the UFW. First, importantly, although not directly answering your question, sorry, Rose,
it's okay.
The Cesar Chavez movie that Diego Luna made with Matthew Pena, Rosario Dawson, the first feature-length film about Cesar Chavez and about the history of agricultural organizing, this important history of Latino movements in California especially, opens on March 28th. And the anniversary, I believe, of Chavez's birthday is the 31st, so it's a great time to go. Some of the theaters that are showing it in the Bay Area have people from the United Farm Workers who work now doing a question and answer afterwards, so that's a good opportunity. In terms of learning which farms have contracts, it's easy to go to ufw.org or to pcun.org. That's the Piñeros y Campesinos Unidos, which is a union up in the Pacific Northwest. And both of these unions together, along with other organizations, are working on something they're calling the EFI, Equitable Farm Initiative, which would be a label on produce that you could buy. So you could buy produce that has a label that shows that it's organic. Mm. You could buy this produce that has EFI on it that shows that it comes from a farm where they're treating their farm workers well.
Are organic farms any better when it comes to treatment of workers?
So in my research, not necessarily. Some organic farms are better and some are worse. So the large farm up in Washington State was contracted part of the land with an organic label and part of the land with a traditional label that used pesticides.
For blueberries.
For blueberries. And ironically, the organic label had made the agreement with the farm that the organic berries would be picked by machines, so machines that drove through the fields and kind of shook the blueberry bushes to get the blueberries off. And the traditional fields were all picked by hand. So that wasn't any choice. You know, those were two different choices separate from each other. But from my perspective, watching human beings picking in the fields with pesticides and seeing machines picking in the fields without pesticides felt sad and ironic.
Seth Holmes is author of Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States. He spent 7 years living in labor camps, picking fruit, migrating, and crossing the U.S.-Mexico border with Mexican migrant farm workers. We're also joined by Vivian Aguirre. She is in her late 20s, and she came from Mexico when she was 5 years old. She's a UFW union member at Maranaca Farms, where she picks and cuts bunches of parsley and cilantro. She says she's on her knees all day cutting bunches. And the weight and the pressure on her knees obviously makes her knees hurt, but also her back ache, and also her arms hurt as well. Just quickly, so even if you're at a farm that's UFW contracted, you're still working 7 days a week, and you still have no access to health care.
So that's a great question. There are differences. Each contract with the UFW includes specific agreements. And like Viviana said, a lot of farms treat their workers poorly in different ways, including subtle things like not promoting people who look a certain way or a certain ethnicity, down to pretty explicit ways of using racist epithets, like, for example, in my research, indio estúpido, which means stupid Indian, or burro or perro, which mean donkey or dog. Some of the managers would say these things to the farm workers. And things like that are a lot less likely to be happening on contract farms. But I think each contract is a little different. So the farms that I visited that have UFW contracts have done some innovations to try to make the picking less hard on people's bodies. They've tried using different rollers that the pickers can work on and things like that. But it'd be a good question for Viviana and for the farm that she's working on what specifically their contract includes there.
All right. Let's just take a few more calls because we're almost out of time and we've got a lot of people on the line. Let's hear from Eduardo in Watsonville. Hi, Eduardo. Welcome to the show.
Hey.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Like I said, I've lived my whole life in Watsonville, and my father-in-law is a strawberry picker, and he gets super, super tired. Sometimes he does work 7 days a week, and it is pretty hard. I have a couple of friends that are undocumented workers, and they've actually haven't been able to go back to Mexico to visit their family members. It's sometimes pretty hard. They are really, really, really hard workers, and that's about it.
All right. Well, thank you for calling. We'll get a response from Seth in just a minute. Let's hear from Stephen in San Francisco. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Rose. Hi, Seth. Glad you made it on the air. I was just wondering, how did your friends and family react when you embarked upon this project?
Great question. Thanks for the question, Stephen. So it was interesting during the field work, during the 18 months full time, my mom and my dad came and visited me. If I remember correctly, my dad slept with me in the labor camp shack. At the time, my boyfriend came and visited me, and different friends came to Oaxaca, to the village of San Miguel. Different friends came to the Central Valley, and different friends came to the farm in Washington. I think one common thing that people said was, for example, one of my friends said that the conditions are 1 inch above squalor. Mm. So they were often kind of compelled by how difficult the conditions were that people were working in. Another common thing that people felt was that a sense that it was sort of a relatively simple situation, that the farmers could easily fix it. And there's a way that farmers definitely can improve the conditions of the farm workers, and supporting unionization through UFW and PECUN and other forms of resistance is important. There's also a sense in which a lot of the farmers feel like their hands are tied by the North American Free Trade Agreement, by economic globalization, by the growing corporatization of farms, so that if a farm owner is trying to run a family farm, they feel especially worried that their farm might go bankrupt because they've seen other friends with other farms go bankrupt and have to sell out to commercial farms, corporate farms. So it's definitely an important big issue that we need to take on a large policy level, I think.
I'm glad you brought up the labor camps, because when Viviana was saying that after a hard day's work, she puts her feet in water, it's not like she's going home. Well, I don't know what her condition's like, but most people, they're not going home to some comfortable bed. I mean, can you just talk about the conditions people live in after working these long days?
Sure. So each of us on the farm lived in a labor camp shack that was probably 9 feet by 9 feet, something like that. And there were plywood walls with tin roofs, so that if it was cold, which it often would get, especially during blueberry season in the fall in Washington State, it would be very cold inside. For example, overnight in the fall, my breath would often freeze on the underside of the tin roof, so that then when the sun would come up in the morning, all that condensed moisture would fall and kind of rain on me and sort of wake me up. We had a hot water hose and a cold water hose that usually, when you started running them, would come out somewhat orange, but then clean up. And then we had two gas burners, kind of like camping stove style, that some people with families would leave on overnight in order to keep their shacks from getting too cold and freezing. I didn't want to do that because of the fumes, so I had an electric blanket that I plugged in that I know you're not supposed to leave on overnight, but that was something that I did to keep myself warm.
And Viviana, before we let you go, as a farm worker who picks and cuts bunches of parsley and cilantro 7 days a week with no health care, what changes would you like to see?
would like to see?
Yes. What changes would you like to see?
Well, I wanted to see that changes is to have better jobs, you know, better jobs and treat it good, treat it with respect. Sometimes we don't have respect for ourselves. Sometimes judges tell us a lot of things, bad things. We want respect for all people, for immigrants.
Seth, what about you? What changes would you like to see after crossing the border, working on the farms?
Well, first I want to say... Oh, go ahead, Viviana.
Yeah, and to have the immigration reform.
Definitely important.
Viviana, we're looking at a picture of you right now, actually.
Right. Someone else who works on the staff at your call just brought in a cell phone with a picture of Viviana working on the farm. Hopefully we can have that posted on the website. So I'm glad that she's been with us. I definitely agree that Viviana, first of all, it's important for her voice to be heard and the voices of other farm workers. That's something I try to do in the book more than just make broad statements. But immigration reform is very important. The possibility of a path to legalization is important. The possibility not of guest worker programs that have some strong problems. A lot of guest worker programs undermine the possibility of farm workers who are already here. For example, farm workers in California, the last I looked, had an unemployment rate of 35%, which is a lot higher than average. And then bringing in guest workers can undercut the people who are already here. Another problem with guest worker programs, the way they've been run, is that usually your ability to be in the United States is tied to your employment contract with one employer. So you're less likely to point out any negative conditions by that employer, because if you lose that job, you have to leave the country.
And just quickly, because we're almost out of time, those of us who care about these issues, what can we do because we eat this food every day?
Great question. So one is look for the EFI, Equitable Food Initiative label. Look at UFW.org and PCUN.org to find out which farms have contracts. Buy food from local farms that you can get to know something about and how they treat their workers. All those are important.
Seth Holmes is author of Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States. And Viviana Aguirre is a UFW member at Muranaka Farms, where she picks and cuts bunches of parsley and cilantro. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you, Seth. And thank you, Viviana. And
thank you
for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss media coverage of the 11th anniversary of the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. How are the media marking the anniversary? And what has become of Iraq 11 years later? We'll also talk about media coverage of the U.S. midterm elections. We'll be joined by The Guardian's Martin Chulov and Salon's Thomas Frank. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KAW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.